The Tom Woods Show, episode 595.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody, don't miss out on the event of the year. Bob Murphy and I are hosting a cruise. That's right, it's the Contra Cruise, October 9th to 16th, 2016, aboard Royal Caribbean. Check it out at ContraCruise.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. We're doing an episode today on the life and thought of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, the late Justice Scalia. He was obviously a very influential and important figure in modern American history. And to talk to us about this, of course, who else would we invite but Kevin Gutzman, who is chairman of the Department of History at Western Connecticut State University. He holds his law degree from the University of Texas at Austin Law School and a PhD in U.S. history from the University of Virginia. He has other degrees as well. He's ridiculously credentialed. He is my co-author on the book Who Killed the Constitution? The Fate of American Liberty from World War I to Barack Obama. He is the author of other books like The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Constitution, a New York Times bestseller, and James Madison and the Making of America. Kevin, welcome back to the show.
Happy to be here, Tom.
Justice Scalia died several days ago, and so we'd like to talk about him, his career, his legacy, his ideas, his importance, all that stuff. I don't know the details surrounding his death. I guess none of us know, and there is something a little bit odd about that. Have you read it, followed any of this about whether or not they're going to have an autopsy?
Yeah, I heard that his family didn't want to have an autopsy. You know, he was 79 years old. He was overweight. He apparently smoked a lot, and I find it totally unsurprising that he died.
All right. Well, I had to get that out of the way just to talk about it. I didn't know if there was anything fishy about it, but I trust you on that. Let's talk about the significance of Scalia. He served a very long time. He was appointed by Ronald Reagan. During Reagan's term, he attempted to nominate, or he did nominate Robert Bork, and of course, Bork was not confirmed, and he was not confirmed because the Democrats portrayed him as an extremist, and you know, he's somebody who would have prevented the Civil Rights Revolution from occurring, which is not true, and he made that clear in his book, The Tempting of America. But anyway, Bork was just railroaded out of, you know, out of bounds. There was no way he was going to get approved. So how is it that Bork would get rejected, but somebody like Scalia would in fact, be named to the Supreme Court?
Well, actually, before I answer that, let me just say something about Bork. At his confirmation hearings, Bork was asked one morning what he thought of the Supreme Court's decision in the case of Bowling versus Sharp, which is the case in which the court, right after it had handed down Brown versus Board of Education, holding that segregating public schools in states was unconstitutional on the basis that the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause banned doing so. In Bowling versus Sharp, immediately after Brown, it said that segregating schools in the District of Columbia was unconstitutional because the Fifth Amendment's Due Process Clause meant that you couldn't do so. And, of course, this is a ridiculous outcome, except in an outcome-driven process that really isn't bound by the Constitution. And so this morning, during his confirmation hearings, Bork said, well, you know, no, I don't agree with Bowling versus Sharp. So apparently, according to one account of the Bork confirmation brouhaha, President Reagan's political advisors took Bork aside over lunch and said, well, okay, here's what we're going to do in the afternoon, but while we're at it, you need to say that you misspoke concerning Bowling versus Sharp, and you don't want to be understood as having said that the case in which the court held that you couldn't have segregation in public schools in D.C. was incorrectly decided. And Bork said, well, oh, okay. So in the afternoon, he went back and said, just a point of clarification, I don't want to be understood as having disapproved of Bowling versus Sharp. There is, I think, no originalist argument for Bowling versus Sharp, but Bork yielded that point.
So he went back and said, now, of course, I was you know, you're a much older guy than I am, Kevin. You probably remember this very vividly, but that was a shot. Why aren't you defending yourself here? You're not that much older than I am. But I was.
Well, a full decade. You were probably in high school when I graduated from law school. So.
Well, I'll tell you, I actually read his book, The Tempting of America, while I was in high school. It was not assigned to me. I read it on my own. But I didn't follow his, you know, his confirmation hearings. I was, you know, I was reasonably precocious as a political observer, but not that much. So I didn't know exactly what was going on. So I didn't know about this particular matter. But you're saying that he came back and said, I don't want to be understood as saying what I obviously just did say? I mean, surely the Democrats must have made hay out of that.
Not only had he obviously just said it, but it was clearly easy to foresee that he would say that on the ground of his general position concerning how to read the Constitution. So there, I think, is no other way to understand his afternoon recantation other than it was political. Basically, he decided he didn't want to be defending the segregationist side in Bowling versus Sharp. But, of course, he could have defended the idea of originalism and applied it to Bowling versus Sharp, but he didn't want to do that. So, again, I don't think we want to understand that Judge Bork was perfectly consistent in his positions. My guess is that he obviously didn't approve of Bowling versus Sharp, but he thought it was a weak political position to take in 1987. So he made a public statement that he approved of it.
Now, I don't remember the order in which Scalia and Bork – well, okay, so Bork failed. Was Scalia named as the next one? What was the order? How did this all happen?
Okay, well, apparently it had long been expected in conservative circles that when President Reagan got a chance after Sandra Day O'Connor, an appointment with which he fulfilled his campaign promise to select a woman, he would choose Robert Bork. But what happened was that in 1986, when Chief Justice Warren Burger announced that he was retiring, people in the Justice Department arranged for President Reagan to meet with their two finalists for the position, Antonin Scalia and Robert Bork. And Scalia went in and met with Reagan first, and apparently he completely won him over. And so when the meeting ended, Reagan told whomever the Justice Department fellow was who was there with the two of them, well, there's our man. And he said, well, no, you're supposed to meet with Robert Bork. And Reagan told him, no, I think this guy's perfect. So what ended up happening, of course, was that it was Bork who ended up being the guy whose appointment would have tilted the court significantly in a rightward direction. I mean, Scalia was just replacing Warren Burger, who certainly was less conservative than Scalia, but still was a Republican, you know, kind of moderately conservative fellow. And on the other hand, when Bork came up, he would have been replacing Southern Democrat Lewis Powell, who in several cases had kind of found ways to continue the leftward direction of the Supreme Court. And so putting Bork in that position would have made a substantial difference. Actually, though, it's likely that if Bork had been appointed to the Burger position and then Scalia had come up at the time that Powell was retiring, Scalia's far more ingratiating personality would have had a completely different kind of effect on the public and on the Senate than Bork's rather aloof, condescending, uncomfortable presentation of himself did. And of course, it was really Bork's combativeness in the Senate Judiciary Committee that sank his nomination, I think. So that actually was a very, very unfortunate series of developments, and it led to Anthony Kennedy being presently on the Supreme Court.
Because it was thought we don't want to have another Bork fight. But if you got Scalia through, then surely you could get another originalist through, you would think. But yet, if I were a Democrat and I wanted to make life difficult for originalists, oh, I could dig up not just the case you mentioned. I could dig up all kinds of embarrassing things that an originalist would either have to abandon his principles to reject or commit political suicide by embracing, all the while claiming that I don't necessarily like the outcome, but the Constitution as originally understood demands it. It seems like Democrats could just do this constantly, which is, I guess, why we haven't had an originalist in a long time.
Well, 1986, when Berger retired, Associate Justice Rehnquist was elevated to replace him, and then Scalia was put in Rehnquist's former place. The Senate was controlled by the Republicans. And then the following year, 1987, when Bork was nominated, the Senate had come to be controlled by the Democrats. So this was a substantially different context. And it's, you know, it's entirely possible that Scalia would have been rejected just as Bork was rejected. But I think there's no doubt that Scalia would have, again, made a better case for himself than Bork did. And actually, when this all happened, I was in my first year of law school, and I can remember standing in the entryway of the Tarleton Law Library at the University of Texas Law School, watching the large monitors they had set up in the foyer as the Senate Judiciary Committee was grilling Bork. And Bork was in the painful position of having to try to conduct intelligent discussions with Joe Biden and Arlen Specter about the Constitution. It was just painful. But of course, the two of them were only trying to elicit statements that would make obvious what was obvious to anybody who knew the story ahead of time, and that was that Bork represented a threat to the unlimited legislative authority of the Senate and to the liberal lawmaking tradition of the Supreme Court. So neither Biden nor Specter, however, of course, you probably recall, came off very well in The Tempting of America.
No. Boy, yeah, after I read that book, I thought I would not want to be on the wrong side of Robert Bork. Whether I agree with him on everything is not in question. I can think of several other people I would not want to be on the wrong side of. I better not say on the air. But anyway, all right, let's talk some more about Scalia. And again, bearing in mind that a good 17% of the audience of this show is from lives in countries other than the United States. So start off by telling people, first of all, what an originalist is, and then was Scalia a consistent originalist?
Well, in America, we have a tradition of telling ourselves that we have a Republican government that was founded through popular consent. That is, that we have a federal constitution that was created by a, for its time, very, very Republican process involving popular elections in all the states to popular conventions whose sole purpose was to vote yes or no on a proposed constitution. And the theory underlying that, of course, was that it was the people who were establishing this government, and that the government would take the form the people thought they were establishing. But what's come to be the case, especially in the 20th century came to be the case, is that the federal officials, especially federal judges, but also members of Congress and presidents, have felt free to act as if the Constitution, rather than reflecting the people's considered judgment, were just a kind of protean object that they could remake as the day's political imperatives dictated, so that they could justify whatever governmental project they might want to undertake, regardless of the fact that the original understanding of the Constitution was that it created a highly limited government and it would leave the federal system highly decentralized. This is unsurprising, of course, in light of the fact that the American Revolution had been made in the name of, well, the slogan was no taxation without representation, but really what that meant was in the name of Republican self-government through local legislative elections. So what Scalia stood for was the attempt to revivify the old idea that the government was supposed to be the kind of government that the people had agreed to in the 18th century. And that meant it was going to be decentralized and Congress would have limited legislative authority in particular. So Scalia, in standing for this, actually reflected the programmatic imperatives of the president who appointed him, Ronald Reagan, and the constitutional views of Reagan's second attorney general, Edwin Meese. Meese, before, I believe it was before Scalia's appointment, gave a very widely discussed speech called Toward a Jurisprudence of Original Intent. And what Mies said in that speech was that it was inappropriate for federal judges constantly to be remaking the Constitution to comport with the latest imperatives of liberal academics and the Democratic Party, essentially. Actually, this wasn't a phenomenon that had only been noticed by American conservatives. There was a widely discussed 20th century book by a British scholar in which that scholar referred to the Supreme Court as a perpetual constitutional convention. And I would say that he actually understated what the court was doing, because of course, a constitutional convention can only propose a new constitution, and the court was in the habit by 1986 of just constantly remaking the Constitution. So Mies said what I was saying earlier, essentially, that in order for the U.S. government to have Republican legitimacy, it had to reflect in its structure the considered consent of Americans when they first agreed to it under the Article 7 process of state-level ratifications. And Scalia was first a prominent proponent of these kinds of ideas when he was a prominent academic. Then he was a prominent proponent of these ideas when he was a lower-level federal judge. And finally, he stood for one version of what's called, again, by Mies, a jurisprudence of original intent, or by Scalia and others, originalism. One thing that Scalia did that was very significant was he took a leading role in establishing a group called the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy. This is a kind of open forum for conservative and libertarian legal discussion, discussion of legal and constitutional issues in American law schools. Originally, it was, when it was founded, it was three of the most prestigious American law schools, but by now it's got chapters essentially in every American law school. And what it does is provide a place for discussion of ideas like the ones I've been describing in American law schools. So you're not going to find a lot of people on American legal faculties who stand for this idea of a limited role for federal judges and a decentralized model of federal government. But through the Federalist Society, people in law schools are able to hear arguments like this from academics and practitioners.
Yeah, can I jump in on that, if I may?
Okay.
Because I've had the good fortune of speaking at a whole bunch of Federalist Society chapters, and you're right. And first of all, a lot of these events are very well attended. They will hold a lot of them at lunchtime and give away free food, so people will show up for that. They'll host debates, which arouses curiosity. People like to watch debates. But it gave me an opportunity to speak, you know, to a lot of audiences. I've spoken on a lot of topics, but I spoke at Columbia Law School about the arguments, the constitutional and historical arguments for state nullification at Columbia, to a packed room at Columbia Law School. I went up and just very matter-of-factly presented this, and not one of them asked me a question afterward. They had never, never heard anything like this, so I felt kind of good about exposing them, you know, giving them this opportunity to be exposed to fresh ideas. But I hadn't known about Scalia's role in all that.
Yes, Scalia was one of the founders, and I, too, have spoken at several Federalist Society chapters. In fact, I'm scheduled to be addressing the same topic, as you just mentioned, at the University of Virginia Law School later on this semester.
How appropriate.
Yeah, so actually, there's also new information about that, which is going to make this kind of interesting. But anyway, so when I was in law school at the University of Texas Law School from 1987 to 90, I was the chapter president one year of the Federalist Society chapter there. And I think that what I heard from Federalist Society members and from academics associated with the Federalist Society and so on shaped the way I thought about the Constitution strongly. And actually, I would attribute much of my later career to the influence of the Federalist Society in the first place. So I think that Scalia's role in founding the Federalist Society and his ongoing the nurturance of that society and his frequent public addresses on related topics have played a substantial role in changing American constitutional culture.
Scalia's influence extended beyond conservatives as well. So today, prominent liberals like Cass Sunstein and Akhil Amar at Yale are prone to start by asking, what was the original understanding? In fact, Jack Balkin has also at Yale now, although formerly of my own legal alma mater at the University of Texas, has tried to formulate an alternative kind of approach to originalism to Scalia's. And I guess imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. In other words, where when Scalia came onto the court and Rehnquist was elevated to Chief Justice, Rehnquist had been a kind of, actually he was commonly called the Lone Ranger because he, I think, set the record for most dissents, solo dissents, 8-1 solo dissents in the history of the Supreme Court. By the time Rehnquist and Scalia were done, by the time Scalia died this weekend, this had come to be not only the predominant position among conservatives, but one with which essentially all liberal constitutional thinkers had to deal as well. So this is a complete change in the way that the constitutional culture was framed. And again, although this was ultimately Reagan's responsibility and Meese was the one who formulated it as a matter of public debate first, Scalia was the chief exponent of this approach to these questions for the whole three decades he was on the Supreme Court.
I guess we should say something about particular decisions. He had a very long tenure, and he wrote many opinions. Are there particular opinions of his that, let's say, either you are especially fond of or that were particularly noteworthy in one respect or another?
Well, boy, there are several things that he did that were extremely important. Of course, he was in the majority in Bush versus Gore. Ultimately, that was the Supreme Court intervention that short-circuited the highly partisan Florida Supreme Court's attempt to remake the outcome of the presidential election in Florida so that Al Gore would be the winner. He also wrote the majority opinion in the Heller case, in which for the first time the Supreme Court held that the Second Amendment established an individual right of gun ownership, which you might have thought was obvious, but there you go. Scalia was the author of the majority opinion in Johnson versus Texas. I think actually this highlights the chief shortcoming of his approach to the Constitution, because in Johnson versus Texas, of course, what he did was that he held there was a constitutional right to burn the American flag and that this was enforceable through the incorporation doctrine against state governments. I, of course, have long held that the incorporation doctrine was just completely unfounded. Scalia didn't actually dispute that point. In fact, in one infamous instance, he said, well, you know, we're not going to refight the incorporation doctrine. So what kind of originalism is that? But in any event, that was obviously a very important decision of his. He also wrote the court's majority opinion in the Smith case, I guess about 25 years ago now, in which faced with a couple of fellows who were members of the Native American Church, whose right included consumption of peyote, and who were asserting through the incorporation doctrine, again, a free exercise claim involving an insistence that they were exempt from a generally applicable ban on peyote use because it was part of their religion, they said. Scalia, for the court, wrote that where there was a generally applicable, facially neutral statute that had a negative impact on someone's religious expression, this did not violate the Free Exercise Clause. That the Free Exercise Clause was about statutes that targeted particular religious practices, and obviously that wasn't what was going on in the Smith case. So people were actually surprised, given Scalia's well-known devotion, his very pious Catholicism. The fact that, you know, this was reflected in his family life very clearly. He was a publicly observant Catholic, too, besides having, you know, 9 children, at least one of whom was a priest, and so on. It was kind of surprising to people that he had come down in this direction. In fact, Congress responded to that decision by adopting the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which was a kind of obviously faulty attempt to correct the Supreme Court's opinion in that case. That had bipartisan support. So in other words, there were a lot of critics of Scalia's performance in Smith. Perhaps the thing for which he's best remembered, or going to be best remembered, is the cogency and the disdainful, mocking tone of several of his dissenting opinions.
That's actually my favorite aspect of Scalia, right there.
Right. Well, there's a really good book published by one of your and my former publishers, Regnery, called Scalia Dissents, which is just a collection of his most notable dissents. And, you know, what he tended to do in these dissents was to mock the Supreme Court's invention of new rights. So you could tell he was angry, but he also was just very funny. And besides that, though, he was the leader of the court's consistent 4-vote minority that objected to the invention of rights to, involving sex. So, for example, the abortion right, the sodomy right, the homosexual marriage right. He insisted these were all completely inconsistent with a federal model of government, and that they had nothing to do with any powers that the Constitution intended to grant to Congress, or with any rights that you could tease out of any provision of the Constitution through any reasonable reading. And of course, actually, in some of those cases, Justice Kennedy had avoided any actual legal argument. So, for example, in the recent Obergefell decision involving assertion by the court that there was a bare majority of the court that there was a right to homosexual marriage, Kennedy didn't even really make a legal argument. He just talked about recent philosophical developments and kind of gave you a 1960s hippie version of the meaning of life and so on. And Scalia had really no time for for this kind of assertion. He would often, you know, come back to the argument that, well, if we're going to have this kind of government, we have to concede that this isn't really a republic. Or he used the word democracy, but he meant a republic. And really what we have here is rule by 9 lawyers. There's nothing more to it than that. There's really no legitimacy underlying these decisions. And he would get very angry, too. In fact, in the 1992 Casey decision, in which, to the surprise of many, the court with 3 recent Republican appointees, all appointed by presidents who had sworn that Roe versus Wade was abominable and they should like to see it eliminated, 3 of these Republican appointees joined in the majority opinion, and actually they wrote a plurality, the 3 of them together. And what they said was, well, it wasn't that they defended Roe versus Wade, but it was that if, after having established this precedent in 1973, the court in 1992 undid it simply on the basis that there had been political expression against it, then the court would undercut its own role in American government and American life. And, of course, what this was just a pretty naked and philosophically really pretty lame assertion that the court ought to have a kind of imperial role in American government. And so Scalia, again, was very angry with this. He thought it was entirely contrary to any reasonable philosophy of Republican society, and certainly contrary to the assertion by American revolutionaries and by the Constitution itself that the Constitution was based on the consent of the governed. So I think these are likely the most important of the decisions, or of the opinions, the decisions, the trains of thought that Scalia laid down in his opinions. But there are just a wealth of funny things and interesting arguments and novel mock coinages and so on sprinkled through his writing. It's the rare body of judicial writing that's actually fun to read.
How would you compare him and his work to the work of Clarence Thomas?
Well, Thomas is a West Coast Straussian, and I think that Scalia was sui generis. So Thomas often, you know, makes assertions about the United States being founded on equality and is prone to mention Abraham Lincoln and, you know, sounds like, you know, a Jaffa follower. And on the other hand, Scalia elaborated an idea of, as Mies put it, again, a constitutionalism, a jurisprudence of original intent. And yet his idea of a jurisprudence of original intent is, although I like that formula and I agreed with basically every word of Mies' speech elaborating this idea in 1985 or 86, I don't agree with all the particulars of the way that Scalia elaborated on that idea, because he, well, for example, when it comes to judicial review, Scalia famously said, you know, in a C-SPAN address, he famously said, you know, we judges made that up. That is, he said, judicial review isn't actually in the Constitution. You can read the Constitution. It's not there. So really, this is something that the judges made up. Well, how did he arrive at that conclusion? He called himself a textualist originalist. So he would start with the text, and then he would say that the text is to be understood as a reasonable person would have understood it at the time. I think this is an alternative to my own personal brand of originalism, which is the one that Thomas Jefferson described by saying, well, the Constitution is to be understood in the sense in which it was advocated by its friends when it was depending before the people. So it, from that point of view, since in multiple states, leading Federalists said that if this Constitution were ratified, there'd be judicial review. And then the argument was basically whether that would be in Virginia, the argument was whether that would be true. Anti-Federalist leader Patrick Henry said, well, that would be great, but I don't believe it'll happen. Then on the other hand, in New York, the chief anti-Federalist, the governor, George Clinton, decried this idea because he said it would be putting the judges above the legislature, and that was not a Republican idea. So in other words, there was a consensus that this was the way the Constitution would work. And I don't know of any evidence to the contrary from the ratification debates. So, again, I think Scalia's quote-unquote textualism is an alternative to the way that people thought the Constitution would work when they would ratify it, when they were ratifying it, that they thought that their understanding in the ratification conventions would be binding on people. And Madison said that too. So, this is one place in which I disagree with him. But in general, I think whatever the particulars of his specific brand of originalism, the idea that originalism was the only path to legitimacy of government really has come to be pervasive. And again, if you're an opponent of this idea, you have to answer it. So, and it's a majority opinion among Republican politicians. My own experience with, you know, talking to various groups and individuals about my books on this subject, or you're in my book and my book on this subject, is that I think activist, non-politician conservatives are even more devoted to it than the verbiage that comes out of the politicians would lead us to believe they would be. And that ultimately is chiefly Scalia's doing. Although, again, it was Reagan's and Mises' program. He's the one who was most responsible for instantiating this into Americans' thinking about these things.
Well, Kevin, before I let you go, would you mind sharing just a brief thought about what's likely to happen next?
Well, Obama will nominate someone, I have no doubt. And if McConnell's to be believed, there will not be a vote on that person's nomination. I should think that they wouldn't have hearings, you know. And there's been a lot of false commentary on McConnell's position. People have said, well, there's a constitutional duty for the Senate to hold hearings, and there's constitutional duty for them to have a vote and so on. There weren't ever hearings on any judicial nomination until the 1930s. So somehow, if this was incumbent upon the Senate under the Constitution for nearly the first century and a half of the Constitution, people didn't know that. This is just a specious assertion. And besides that, there, of course, have come to be widely known statements by prominent Democratic senators within the last decade that when the shoe was on the other foot, they would forego considering nomination of any Republican candidate to the Supreme Court. So I think, again, that Obama surely will nominate someone. The question is what kind of person he'll nominate. Will he nominate a moderately liberal person, hoping maybe that some of the Republican senators will decide to go along with the Democrats and insist that there be a vote? Or alternatively, will he nominate somebody like the other two people he chose, who obviously were both chosen on the ground of their quote-unquote race, class, gender backgrounds? He could choose somebody like that and hang him out there and have Hillary Clinton run for, you know, in the fall campaign on the basis of if you elect me, then I will ensure that this fabulous affirmative action candidate for the Supreme Court is put on the Supreme Court. After all, this would be a great way to cement President Obama's fabulous legacy. That seems to me likely, actually, don't you think?
I'm afraid so. And I don't know why I was looking to Kevin Gutzman for some cheery other alternative scenario that might occur.
You should know better than that by now.
Exactly. I don't know what I was thinking. Well, listen, I'm really glad that we had a chance to talk about this, and I just want to say you are a tremendous asset to us at libertyclassroom.com. I consider it a point of boasting that we have you as a faculty member over there. So I hope people who have not checked that out will now feel like they have yet another reason to check out libertyclassroom.com. Best of luck with all your projects. I want to catch up with you soon about how your stuff is going. I don't want to ask you now because I really need to let you go and get to sleep. But thanks again. We'll talk to you again soon.
You're welcome.
All right, everybody. If all goes well, tomorrow we'll be talking to Jeff Deist of the Mises Institute on the general subject of what should be done. There is a lot of talk and a lot of criticism of people who do nothing but talk about problems and don't talk about solutions. Okay, so we're going to talk strategy tomorrow with Jeff Deist, who always impresses me. Every time I hear one of his talks, I'm envious of him because he, I think, more or less off the top of his head, just has all these profound thoughts, and that's a really neat thing. So we're going to talk to Jeff tomorrow. Also, those of you who have never read one of my books, let me tell you, I personally am the happiest with my most recent book, which was from late 2014, called Real Dissent. The subtitle is A Libertarian Sets Fire to the Index Card of Allowable Opinion. That's my favorite just because it gives you kind of a sampling of all the sorts of topics that I've written about over the years. And it's punchy, but informative and fun and an easy read. So if you don't have that, please check it out. It's super cheap, too. If you get the Kindle edition, it's like $4, and it's a really meaty book. So it'll be like the best $4 you ever spent. You can check it out at realdissent.com, and there you'll even find a link to get the audiobook version for free, and I actually read the audiobook version. So how about that? So that's zero. So come on now, $4 or zero. And of course, there's also at Amazon, a discounted paperback edition, also linked at realdissent.com. So if you're enjoying the show, then I think you will enjoy this book as well. So please do me a favor and take a moment to check out realdissent.com, and we'll see you tomorrow for some strategizing.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.